Okay, let's do it.
It's great to be here again today with Andrea Hyatt. Andrea, as you might remember from our first conversation, has a background in philosophy and neuroscience and is also working on technoscience. So we have a lot in common to talk about because she also enjoys talking about how things scale. And before I forget, I want to mention that I'm going to be speaking at an estuary conference in the Pacific Northwest in September, and I will put all the information about that in the description section for anybody who's interested in going. It's going to be a 2.5 day conference, September, I think roughly 13th, 14th, and 15th, but I'll put the details in the description section. So it's good to be here with you today, Andrea. I'm looking forward to this, and I know that one of the things we wanted to talk about was failure and risk taking, and we were going to start there and see where it goes. So I wonder if you could kick
Yeah.
off.
Well, hi, Karen. It's so good to see you again and catch up a little bit. You've had so much going on, and that conference sounds really interesting. I want to know more. Maybe there's, I guess it's not online, but it's probably no way I can get there. But
Oh,
anyway,
it
maybe
is
we can
online.
talk about that a little. Oh, it is? Oh, okay, cool.
There's a web page that I'll put in the description section for it.
Oh, good. It's okay. Okay. So, yeah. We were going to start with failure, or this idea of what error, failure, mistakes. I don't know. I haven't really thought about it too deeply yet because we've had a few start and stops, like we were going to talk and then we had to postpone it a few times. But I don't know. It's such a big word. It's such a hard word, isn't it? Failure. I was trying to think of it just before we got on today, and I was thinking of how when I, because we've talked about scaling and linearity, and you just talked about the conference and your topic, and this is an important thing. And so I was thinking earlier, just kind of while I was finishing up some other work, about if we think of life linearly, then failure seems to have a particular kind of position. Like if you fail, it's almost as if this kind of line of your life has stopped or come to an end, or I don't know, or that somehow you can never kind of get over it. I don't know. It seems very static, I would say. But I was trying to think of it as like more nested and scaled. And what is failure? I think when we brought the subject up, we were talking about it as almost like a nurturing or something that actually a lot of creativity comes out of. Is that how it came out in our conversation?
Yeah, I think we were talking.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember hearing the phrase years ago, failure is your springboard for success,
Oh, yeah.
which is a more positive spin on it, right? Rather than just some people probably have more the personality where failure causes them to crawl under the bed.
Yeah.
And I've been there. I've definitely been there.
Is it failure or is it embarrassment? I mean, these are like, I was trying to think of what, because failure, okay, you try to do something and you mess up, right? That's an error or a failure. But why are we embarrassed by it? It's like, I was thinking of that earlier too today. I mean, this is a really trivial example, but I was thinking of how I've always been terrible at social media. It's never felt good for me. When all my friends were doing Facebook, I just couldn't really do it. I don't know why. I mean, it really feels like something I should go to therapy about or something. I don't know, like, or maybe not. Maybe I should
Maybe
just
they should go to
be who
therapy
I
for
am.
being stuck on Facebook.
I don't know, but it felt like a failure, let me just say that. Because everyone's thinking about their likes and I just couldn't even, I still have a lot of trouble with it. And of course, like as an author or as when you do things publicly and other people are involved in it, they want you to promote it and stuff. And it's just always been, I can't figure out what it is. But in any case, there's something tied up in that with kind of embarrassment too, of if I put myself out there and then like you don't know what's going to happen, a lack of control. All of that maybe is what is the hard stuff about failure. And maybe that ties into also why it does become kind of a success, because that's one little area of my life that, well, it's social media that feels very uncomfortable for me and very hard. But in other areas, I'm really all about like edge work and taking risks. And I've gone a lot of paths that aren't normal paths, not really on purpose, but it just felt natural for me. kind of the opposite of how I feel trying to do something like social media. And then I do think of failure as a means to success. I don't even think of it as failure so much as like pushing up against what I've been told is kind of the limits of myself. And when you do that, of course, you have error, you know. But that's the way you sort of can create a new path. I mean, I would think of it like that. But is that making any sense to you? Have you had any?
Oh, totally. I mean, yeah. The whole thing about pushing up against your limits, I think that's just part of the pattern of the way life is supposed to go, because you don't know what you can do until you push beyond your capacity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes when we fail, it's because we took some sort of a risk, pushed beyond our capacity, and down we go.
Yeah. Well, that's a fine line too, isn't it? Because we don't want to push too far. I mean, I don't know if you've dealt with that, but I've also dealt with that, because in something like edge work, or in something like when you do take on that orientation, like, okay, I'm going to approach life with at least the capacity to be wrong or to mess up or to fall. If you take it too far, then you might also kind of get lost, you know, or, you know, for example, like maybe you think drugs are the way to do that, which would be kind of an error that actually could lead to not success, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it could maybe in moderation, I don't know, people say, but do you see what I mean? There's this kind of, that's why I was trying to think of it not linear, but more like I need to expand what's really happening when in a life we do something that's feels like an error or a failure or an embarrassment, and how all those are tied together. But have you had that kind of moment ever where you almost went too far, or you?
Well, I mean, I think obviously, or maybe it's not so obvious, but we have to kind of separate out categories of risk taking, because there are kinds of risk taking that we have enough knowledge now to realize that they can lead to death. I was just thinking the other day, for some reason, about I don't even know why, somebody was talking about knocking back shots. And I thought,
knocking back shots, like,
yeah,
with a
like
shot
like
glass,
shots
yeah.
of whiskey. Yeah, shots of whiskey. Oh, I think maybe we were talking about my yeah, I can't remember what it came up. But anyway, we were talking about that, and I said, it's stupid. It's just stupid, because people don't recognize what their limit is, and you can die from alcohol poisoning very easily. So you're knocking back shots, and you think, oh, I can handle it. I can handle three or four. But after three or four, you don't know what you're doing anymore. So then you just keep knocking them back, you know, and pretty soon you're over the limit, and then you're dead. So when we're young, that kind of stuff just seems normal.
Yeah.
I used to teach art in a small school, and one of the boys, I mean, this isn't really funny, it's tragic, but one of the boys was kind of a wild man. He's like 9 years old or 10 years old at the time, and just very, always pushing against the limits. And he decided one summer he could fly, and he jumped off the roof of their house.
Whoa.
And
He really thought he could fly.
He was aiming for the swimming pool. But
Oh
he
my
missed the
gosh.
swimming pool and hit the concrete and broke his, I believe he broke his leg and three ribs or something like that. It was really
Oh no.
bad. And
Oh no.
But that's the kind of risk taking that hopefully you grow out of. You begin to understand that there are limits to our human capacity to survive. And you don't want to go beyond those limits. But when you talk about not being linear, I think too often we think of life as being linear and progress, and we're always moving along this line, but actually isn't it more like a tree? You keep coming to junctures, and at each juncture you have to make a decision. Am I going to go left or right? You know, a zero or a one, you know, which one am I going to do? So you're always making choices.
Yeah.
And those choices obviously need to be guided by what you already know, and guided by your interest in what you don't know. So that Peterson always talks about that capacity for self-interest, for not self-interest, but capacity for interest that is unique to each person. that's kind of standing out in front of you in each moment, then that interest is drawing you forward.
Capacity for interest. As you know, I mean, that's new to me because I'm new to that, this world, but that makes a lot of sense to me because, of course, with the way making, with that, the whole, one of the main reasons or motivations behind trying to articulate this kind of different framework of what's happening with lived experience is to get past this, these dichotomies and these linearities, but also that we start to understand that everyone has this development from the moment they're born in all different landscapes, like, of course, geographically, but also we're developing in our social landscape, our linguistic landscape, our emotional landscape. There's all these layers and scales of it. And all of that would kind of have to do with that capacity, wouldn't it? Like almost that trajectory that you're always kind of pushing ahead of yourself just a little bit, or, and that's setting the parameters for you that are different for other people. Is that close to what he's saying too, or?
Yeah, I mean, on many levels, he brings up, and I think he got this from somebody else, actually, it's not his own thing. Maybe it was Jung that said that sparkle of interest that's out there in front of you that's kind of drawing you forward is actually your future calling you forward.
Yeah, the things that speak to you. Yeah.
And when I think about that, I kind of translate it back to being a mother and having a toddler, or maybe even before a toddler, you have an infant. And the infant hasn't learned to crawl yet, but they can sit, let's say. So they're sitting there and they see a little ball across the room, brightly colored ball that they want to go get, but they can't get there because they don't know how to crawl. So they will try over and over and over. And I mean, they will just keep trying. They'll fall. They'll get back, you know, they'll try to get themselves right back. They'll fall. And then eventually they get to where they can crawl, you know, one step after another, get over and get that ball. But then maybe they see something a little higher up on the shelf. They want that. They can't get there until they can stand. And they will try and try and try and try. So the way that we grow our capacity has to be that there's something that we want that we don't have. So it's this idea of a value scale. Without value, nothing can happen. I think that's the basic idea. If there isn't something that's better than what you have now, you're not going to move. So you want that next thing more than you are. You're willing to put yourself through a lot in order to get that thing that you want. But if you didn't have something you wanted, why not just stay where you're at? You know.
Yeah, there's motivation. Of course, that's also too on a lot of layers. I like what you just said because that relates a lot to the failure idea of, you know, you could say that as kids when we're learning to walk, we fail all the time. I mean, we fall down, we get hurt, or when we're trying to reach for that object. And each of those so-called failures, that word is so loaded, are actually more like adjustments or calibrations or something.
Calibration
like that,
is a
you know?
Great word. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess it's no, I mean, that seems like a physical example of the body, of course, in space. But also we're doing that with language and we're doing that. I mean, these are all physical spaces, but we tend to kind of talk about them as if they're not. So we're doing that with emotional space. You know, when you have relationships, you kind of, you might see something that you really want and you're drawn towards it and the desire, the love, the passion, and then you get hurt, you mess up, and so you recalibrate your actions, you know? So I think that fits in a lot of different spaces, the way we learn language. And I guess the question is, I'm not sure I know what you mean by value, and also that why do we think of that as, why are we, because you brought up embarrassment, why is this something we try to hide from one another, as if we don't fail? You know, you look, I think that's one reason I have trouble with social media. Like, I don't know how to be honest there, you know, because when you're saying things as they are there, it's awkward because that's a space where you don't talk. I mean, maybe you do now, I don't know, but in some way, when I was looking at it, it's more like you should create a kind of success story, you know, but if what we're saying is true, then a lot of the success is actually through this error and recalibration. And I don't know if that's like fits into our images and representations and media so well. At least not when it's directly personally related. When we watch movies or we read books, of course, that's where we connect. But when we're being seen as individuals, I think it's harder. Maybe because of that linearity. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I can't hold social media up as a place to learn anything really valuable because,
No,
I
but it's
mean,
such a wonderful tool. I'm always frustrated because I just think, gosh, you know, how many people I know in so many different countries, and I'm like, Facebook is amazing for keeping in touch. And but yeah, I know what you're saying. You're right.
well, I mean, let's say on Facebook, and I have seen this happen with some young people that I have been connected to on Facebook, where they'll say something like, I'm really not doing well today, and I can't see any point to life.
Oh.
Okay, now people might feel that way quite often, right? There's a lot of people who have that feeling quite often. But you put that out there on social media, and what happens? Some people will come
Nothing.
and say, "Is there some way that I can help you?" Other people will come in and say, "You're a stupid failure," and they'll go after
Oh.
you. Oh yes, haven't you ever seen that on Facebook where,
No, because I'm very, I have a page or something that someone made for me, but I really don't. I don't know how to do it. I mean, yeah,
yeah, well, that
I
kind of
don't do
thing
it.
happens on Twitter all the time too, or just vultures will come in after you. And if you put something vulnerable out there, they will tear you to pieces. And then
Really?
you're really in trouble, right?
Oh,
So
wow.
I don't think
See,
social
I.
media is the place to test the limits, right?
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Man, that's, I didn't know it was so bad. I mean, I feel like maybe I've shielded myself a bit from it. I mean, I have accounts there for the podcast, for example. I just made one and stuff, but I don't really, I don't know. I just hear stories about how it is. I also feel weird looking around there, like you're, I think I like it for philosophy and science because you can look at like get papers and things like that. That I like. It seems like it would be good because people are always talking about something they found on social media, but when it comes to failing and dealing with failure, I wonder why people react like that. Is it because they're taking it like they want to distance themselves from it? I mean, what do you get out of someone being vulnerable and showing that they've made a mistake and like using that against them? What's coming out of more attention, I guess?
Yes,
Don't know.
attention. The phrase that people use is virtue signaling. You know,
Oh,
I'm not as bad
yeah.
as you are, right?
Right.
And I totally agree with you about finding papers and finding thinkers. That's how I use Twitter. I mean, I use Twitter strictly to just
That's
find
great. I wish
interesting people and then
I would like to try to learn how to do that.
keep up
I use
conversation.
LinkedIn for that. I am on LinkedIn. That one feels kind of healthy. I started that a few months, some months ago, and that's been really good for that.
Yeah. So, but just before that, you said something that, oh, about it, you were talking about pushing up against the unknown,
Yeah.
and how that fits in with Jordan Peterson's ideas. And I heard him once in a talk that he was having with Roger Scruton about transcendence. And Peterson said, when you get to the edge of the unknown, that's where the transcendence shows up.
Yeah.
So, and he also said that, in fact, I might even have the quote from his book if I could find my notes. Not.
Which book is it?
Well, so he wrote Maps of Meaning,
Oh
which is
yeah, we were going to talk about
gigantic
that
book,
one.
which I have thousands of notes sticking out of.
Whoa.
Here's my maps of meaning.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
Wow.
he
I
says
thought I was bad with notes.
Luciferian pride is
Ooh.
to say all that I know is all that is necessary to know. It's a totalitarian assumption of omniscience. So, and he gets that from John Milton's Paradise Lost, because in that, the characterization of Satan is one who believes that he knows everything and doesn't need anything outside of himself. And so if you come to that place, then there's no creative exploration, because if you know everything, then you're completely static.
Mm-hmm.
Creative exploration mm-hmm. comes out of a willingness to confront the unknown.
Yeah.
You're going to confront the unknown one way or another, either mm-hmm. involuntary or voluntary. Because sometimes you're just thrust into the unknown because something terrible happens. You're in a car accident, you break your arm and your car is all smashed up. And now you've got to get to the hospital. You got to find a way to get your car fixed. All sorts of unknowns happen. And maybe that makes you miss the appointment that you were going to have to go and interview for a great job or something like that. So all kinds of things can come out of that. There's a whole bunch of chaos in that situation. That's the unknown. That is another word that Peterson uses for that is the anomaly, when you confront the anomaly. But the way that you strengthen yourself is to confront the unknown in a voluntary way. So then you build up your muscle for the unknown, let's say.
Voluntary, as if you've made the choice and you're consciously going to.
Yes, you're consciously going to. So, and one of the examples he uses is, as a clinical psychologist, he says, if you have somebody who's deathly afraid of elevators, they can't get in an elevator, but maybe they're willing to go with you and at least look at an elevator.
Mm.
So you take that small step towards the unknown. And then maybe the next time you can move a little bit closer to the elevator and look at it until eventually you can get on the elevator. So that's a way of confronting the unknown step by step and getting strengthened. Right.
Right. That sounds like a lot of, that's a pattern, I think, that, you know, in cognitive behavioral therapy or a lot of different psychology that I'm sure he's bringing into that.
Yeah.
That's definitely, yeah. That, how much can you handle of what you, what is seemingly threatening you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, it reminds me too of yin and yang, of always every part having a little bit of the other part in it. And that kind of process is one that can be, I mean, I think it's the process of life. It's connected to Bohm and Hegel and all the things I've studied, but, and the Tao and the way, it's one reason I use that word. And, but I think it's also like, it's how we heal too, is of course it's how we interact, how we get to know each other, how we, it's a life process of how we're dealing with our encounter. But when we do it consciously, as you said, or voluntarily, where we've put our attention on this and we've like, then it changes. We're having more agency about how we shift and change those parameters in a way that's really interesting. And I think very connected to something like what you just described and different kinds of therapy and different kinds of ways in which you can begin to communicate with whatever it is that's your ailment that's bothering you, that's threatening you, that's of course always part of you, right? Mm-hmm. But also outside. So it's this inner outer connection, like the yin yang symbol kind of, you know, shows us, but it comes across in many other things. But when you were talking about that, I was thinking about the more embodied literature, and because that's kind of closer to me and my reading of, you know, something like inactivism, or I don't know if you've heard of a guy named Hans Jonas. He has this wonderful, beautiful notion of needful freedom. I love those words together. It reminds me of this process I was just trying to describe of, so basically it's like our bodies, any organism always coincides with its own dynamical material. He probably says it a little better than that, but you basically have this kind of constitution, material constitution, but you never actually fully coincide with that. Because of that kind of movement I was just describing, where you're always interacting with the world and the world with you. There's always a little bit of you in the world and a little bit of the world in you. Because it's one process, actually. It's not separate. And so there's this need, this tying of you, yourself, to that world in a way, because you're constantly dependent on it, right? Because you're part of it. I mean, we can't get away from all that we encounter because it is part of us and we need it to continue our body, you know? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's because you never fully coincide with it, there's always a freedom there. There's always this, it's almost like we could think of it as a kind of failure or mistake in terms of that those things never match up perfectly. So you always have this this freedom that implies this relational capacity. So something like what you described with the voluntary edge work or voluntary confronting of what you fear can happen because of that freedom. If you were just needful, you wouldn't have that agency. If you were completely like coinciding with your body, so to speak, or completely coinciding with who you are in the sense that you weren't always in this ongoing interaction with the world that's part of you, then you would only be needful, but you have needful freedom, so you can have that agency. And that's interesting to think of in terms of failure. And even I think of now, as I'm saying, he also brings in Darwinism a little bit. And when you think of evolution, what is a mutation, right? It's a mistake. It's an error. It's a so-called failure in the DNA. But it's actually also the only reason we have evolution and adaptation and variation. So yeah, there's a lot of patterns there. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, what I just said, but.
Well, so when he's talking about the needful freedom, is that similar to, well, Carl Friston says this, and I'm sure he's not the only one, that every organism must have a model of the world in order to function in the world. So that model of the world is built into the organism in order to function in the world. So you have the in and the out both happening at the same time. So you have a model of the world, a map of the world, so to speak, inside, and then you're navigating the world. And then where the navigation doesn't line up, then you have to either have catastrophic failure, or somehow that model that you have has to get remade a little bit. You're always adjusting the map, just like a cartographer would go out there and build a map of the world, and eventually they have to change it because a map can never be perfectly aligned with the world, because the map is not the reality, right?
Right, exactly. The map is not the territory. You're talking about all kinds of things that I'm interested in. And I think, yeah, I'm with this Active Inference Institute, and Carl's active inference idea is a part of my life and inspiring. At the same time, it's tricky to think about this, right? And important to think about this, about having models and being a model, the difference between these things, because I mean, as I was, what you just described is true, but it's also, there's a lot of nestedness going on there too. So like when we think of the child that you described, like reaching for the stuff, it's not that they have a model in their mind yet. They are the model, and they're creating the model in that ongoing needful freedom and interaction. And Friston is very much aware of all this literature with embodied inaction and active cognition. And his work addresses this in good ways. But I guess the point I'm trying to say here is that your body is the model too. We also do become aware of our thoughts and so on. And there's ways in which we do kind of have models of our models. I mean, it gets like this nestedness goes on and on, but it's not that we, that needful freedom, that embody that's in that encounter, that embodied organism that's in that encounter is the model. There's no, like, you can't separate it, because you can't separate the body and the encounter. We do it in order to make sense of the world. And it's important. Like, that's why we separate ourselves into I and you and we and she, and we name each other. All of that is important and real, but ultimately we're all connected and interrelated. And so relation and intersubjectivity is the kind of actual process that, because we can never separate from all of this. So we're constantly changing our very embodiment, and that is changing our model. And we also have these other layers of where we've internalized language, and we have certain ideas that we're aware of. And those two are that we're using as, like you said, like the map. And when we bring those into question and begin to change those, and we change the map, then we start to change how we can move through that encounter. So again, it's hard to talk about because it's so nested, but I think it's great that you brought that up, because that's very similar to that idea of needful freedom and actively moving through the world as a body, and you're kind of aligning with the world, and you're processing it, and you're as you do that, there are certain regularities and certain maps that you make that you then don't even have to think about anymore. In the same way, like we learn how to walk, you just do it, you know, and that keeps kind of building on and on. So we do it with our thoughts too, and we don't recognize anymore that we're perceiving the world through these particular lenses, but we could change those lenses, which I guess is what something like what Peterson is trying to help people do with those
yeah,
ideas.
Yeah, I mean, if we take it back to Peterson and scale it up and look at it as, let's say, the social level, the way he talks about the yin yang, in at least at the social level, is that on the one side you have order, you have like a city, a walled city, and within that walled city there is order, and then outside the walled city is where the unknown and the chaos and people tend to look at, you know, especially more primitive societies looked at the unknown as being filled with foreigners and serpents and what, you know, anything that they'd ever encountered that was scary is outside.
Although so there's plenty of scary inside the city too, but I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I mean, inside ourselves, but I see what you're saying. Like, yeah, that's a way it's often thought of. There's the inside where it's safe and the outside.
Well, this is
it's...
why in the yin yang, you have the, I can't remember which side is order and which side is chaos, but you have the little dot inside of there. So that's the snake inside the ordered part. And then out in the disordered part, there's also a little part, which is the ordered part or the little treasure.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the idea is when you encounter the unknown, if you've had the experience of voluntarily encountering the unknown, then you realize that in the unknown, there are things that you can find that will help you when you move back into the known territory. But sometimes if you fall involuntarily into the unknown, everything just looks scary. It just looks foreign. But if you can recognize, okay, here I am in this chaotic situation, but there's probably something I can learn here. And it's that willingness to look around and see in the chaos to find the little treasures, Peterson connects it to the snitch in Harry Potter, you know, get the little golden orb and bring it back into your ordered world. And what that does then is that makes the ordered world less static, makes it more dynamic. It brings freshness in and makes it more alive again. So the way that we can't grow if we don't have these experiences where we bump up against the unknown and find our alignment there and then bring that back in and then keep moving. And this is why I talked earlier. You said you didn't quite understand why the whole framing of the idea of value.
Yeah. Well, I'm just not sure how you use that word because I come from one way of you. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, let's look at, say, Mark Solms when he talks about the arising of consciousness through the brainstem, where originally, if you accept that model, then you're saying that the brainstem was the place where the judgments are made. It's too hot or it's too cold, and so adjustment needs to be made so that I can stay alive. So there are, you know, maybe I need to move further into this, or and I, you know, not that the brainstem is thinking these things, but it's just moderating the organism, whatever the organism is. That brainstem part is moderating and making decisions based on values: too hot, too cold, too light, too dark. What keeps me alive is moving towards the thing that is going to keep my, you know, my thermostat in the right place. That is a value judgment. So if it's too hot right now, moving towards cold is better than staying where I'm at. That's a value judgment. That's the word value that I'm talking about.
So that, I'm glad you clarified that, because that for me, I mean, yes, we could talk about the brainstem and, or what all this means, but I know what you mean. And that's an embodied, of course, the brainstem is crucial for that, for a human. But that's an embodied, similar to what you were just talking about with Friston or this idea of needful freedom, there's a kind of aligning or gauging or calibrating that's constantly going on at different levels, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just like what you described the brainstem is doing, and to be honest, the whole body's always doing this. The brainstem is the part that's probably like crucial for humans in that way, or this different areas of the brain, but yeah, so there's a kind of that could speak to this predictive processing or not predictive processing, more active inference idea of where you do constantly kind of regulate the entropy in which you are both being nurtured by it and encountering it, but also you must kind of keep it at bay in order to survive. And yeah, so you, that's a kind of a value that you mean. And that seems more like almost like mathematical value, not just that we're in the realm of, you know, what's more meaningful necessarily on a cognitive, metacognitive, or on that kind of level. So I like what you said, that feels very bodily. And I think that's where it starts. And weirdly, that also makes me think of failure, because like when you trip, when you're walking along and you trip, your body knows something has misaligned and there's a feeling like embarrassment. So maybe if you scale that up a little bit, that's similar to the way we feel when we make these mistakes in more like representational space through our interactions with each other, through talking or on social media or whatever, you know, and we feel embarrassed. There's probably something very beneficial about it, is what I'm saying. But in the same way you said we could become aware of it and get close enough to it to begin to have agency over it, maybe that's what we're trying to do with this idea of failure a little bit too, to understand that with those kind of sentences, like the one you read from, I guess it was Jordan and the other, to see it as a success, that's a kind of agency change of being able to look at the failure, get close enough to it to have some agency over what it's meant and what it means and how likely the next time you encounter it, how much better you might deal with it, right? Which is to that changing of your alignment with the world.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't see how, I mean, everybody fails all the time. So
why are we so embarrassed and worried about it? And why do we hide it from each other? And like, what, well,
you know,
why shame, do we make fun of each other? Why do we hurt
shame,
each other?
Shame was one of the first things felt in the garden, you know? So, when God said, Adam, where are you? And Adam said, I was ashamed, so I hid.
Yeah.
That's the very first thing, because
he became aware of himself as an object, right? So that's kind of tied to this too, maybe in a way. Adam became aware of Adam as a named self distinct from the garden, which we all do as kids.
And he became aware of his nakedness, you know?
Well, that's kind of the sign of it, that you, like, you're not naked till you realize you're an object, and that, you know, then there's a such thing as nakedness. I mean, otherwise you're just, like, animals aren't naked. I mean, but yeah, there's something about that process of becoming aware of yourself as a subject, separating yourself from the garden, from the encounter, from all that is there, and then learning, returning to that state somehow of being, realizing you never really were separate from it, and it's all part of you. But if you have your attention turned to it in a different way, in the way you've been describing, it's a completely different experience to be in that space, right? I mean, the Adam who doesn't know he's Adam, who's enjoying the beautiful space, and then the Adam who knows he's in that space, what's different there? There's an awareness or an attention or a consciousness of consciousness, which can then also become a consciousness of the tree and of the animals and of everything around. So you can, perhaps you can even start to understand self in even wider scales. You know, I don't know if we've begun to do that yet. I hope we can, but it doesn't feel like I should condemn that process, I guess is what I'm saying, even though it's the sign of sin in the Bible, and we don't want to be in that state. But is sin a failure? Do we need to learn from that? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, if I'm going to take the words, yeah, sin is a big word. I think
it's too big of a word, but that's, yeah. We brought up Adam, and that's what it is in the Bible, right? He sinned, and then he.
Yeah.
Or do I remember it wrong?
But the way I think of sin, and I am not a theologian at all, but the way I think of sin is not a bunch of discrete sins, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other thing. But a loss of trust in God's goodness, because the serpent said to Eve, oh, really, did God say that you shouldn't eat of any tree in the garden? And she said, yes. And he said, not only don't eat of it, but don't touch it unless, you know, you die. And what she was doing was adding something onto what God had said. God had just said, don't eat of this tree. You can eat of all the other trees, but you can't eat of this tree. Mm. And when Satan kind of convinced her, well, he's holding out on you, you know, if you eat this, you'll become like God, and then that'll be better.
No.
So she buys into that. What she's
Sounds
really
like social
done,
media.
Yeah. She's lost her trust in the goodness of God, and she has made a decision on her own to throw away that trust and to listen to Satan. And to me, that's the sin right there. I know better, you know, I know better. I know everything I need to know. I can eat this apple or this fruit or whatever it is of good and evil. And then I'll know even more than I know now. And then I won't need anybody outside myself. I don't need to trust in God's goodness. I can do this on my own. But then when we do that, we are much more vulnerable to failure. Because if we're living in a world in which we don't recognize the goodness of God, then we're living in a world that is not attuned to reality. So we're going to have failure after failure after failure, because reality is that God is good. And my living outside that world means that I'm going to have failures. And when I have failures, I'm going to have shame, because shame is the first thing that comes along.
But it doesn't have to. If we understand what we're calling failure in a different way, if we understand it as more like a marker that's going to open up some kind of portal for us, if we can put our attention on it and sit with it and look at it honestly, if we can look at our actions honestly and learn from them and not judge ourselves, not that any of this is easy, but I think it relates to all these themes and also to what we try to learn through, you know, our interaction with what I might call love, you know, and we do kind of learn how to sit in that space long enough to accept whatever it is that was embarrassing, look at it. If we're not being judged, then can we kind of start to change that a bit? Do we have to feel shame? Because shame almost seems, at least in this, when I'm thinking of it in Adam and Eve terms, it's almost like you don't have the space. You don't have the space to not feel judged, even if it's just you that's judging yourself. And also you didn't have enough awareness to change, to know that it's not you, right? That you're not going to be defined by that somehow. I don't know. Shame is just hard. I mean, that's a hard thing for people to feel. I guess I just don't want people to have to feel that. I want to find some way
that's the good news of the gospel, though, Andrea. Mm. That's the good news of the gospel.
Well, that's what love does.
You don't need to feel shame, yeah. Right? I mean, if you know that you're safe in God's hands and you've stumbled and fallen, it's just like a child stumbles and falls. There's no need to be ashamed of that. You stumbled and fell because you didn't know that rock was there or whatever, and your parent picks you back up again, puts you back on your feet, and off you go. There's no shame. There doesn't need to be any shame there, because you know you're in a safe place. And so when you're in that safe place and you know that you're loved and you know that that God is good, and that, you know, the way Peterson puts it, when he talks about truth, and he said, speak the truth, or at least don't lie, because speaking the truth all the time is very, very difficult, because we don't always know what the truth is, but we can at least try to focus on not lying. And that can sometimes get you into very big trouble, right?
Do you have an example in mind? What do you mean?
Well, let's say I live in communist Soviet Union. And there's five people in my family, and the numbers were that out of every five people, three people were spies for the government. So there's three people in my family that are probably going back and telling everything that they're hearing that's going on in the household. So if I have a thought about this unfair government, but then I hold it in and I don't speak it because I'm afraid of the retribution that will happen. I'm going to be taken away in the middle of the night if they find out that I'm against the government, right? So if I hold that in and I don't speak it, basically I'm lying with my life. But if everybody does that, if everybody lies, then the society just falls apart. And that's what happened in the Soviet Union. It was just destruction after destruction. But if people spoke the truth, Solzhenitsyn spoke the truth. He wrote that book, and that was a big part of breaking the back of the Soviet structure, because he was willing to speak the truth. And so when you speak the truth, or when you at least don't lie, then there is some kind of hope for the future, even if that means that I might face retribution. It might look to me like this is not personally good for me. I'm going to speak the truth, but I'm going to run into trouble. But what Peterson says is, no matter what the consequences, it's the best thing in the long run. And your consequence might be that you end up in prison. Your consequence might be that you even end up dead. But the thing that I think we all have to keep in mind is that I am not the center of the universe. And there's something more going on here. There's a bigger, greater thing. So my going to prison or dying might mean freedom for many, many other people that comes out of my speaking the truth. And, you know, I mean, the Christians had to confront this within the Nazi era, because some of them were hiding Jews in their house. And, you know, so the Nazis come and knock at the door and they say, "Are you hiding Jews here?" So I even heard of one story where one of the Christians in the house said, "Oh, yes, we are. Just come in. Take a look. I'm hiding Jews everywhere." Mm-hmm. And they spoke it. They spoke the truth so boldly that the Nazis just thought, would you shut up? You're just being annoying. They left. Oh.
So that would be an example of, well, in that case, they actually told the truth. But because it's hard for me to, I understand what he means, like, at least don't lie. But then in the example you just gave, you kind of said being silent is a kind of lie. So, and a lot of it has to do with, it can also, like, politically, right? If I think in politics, this can be turned around, because people can say what isn't a lie, but they know how it's going to be interpreted. So they're actually saying it to get the opposite effect, but then they can't really get caught, you know, this kind of language of this Orwellian kind of speak, right?
Yes, or, yes, exactly. Yeah.
So that's also, or at least don't lie is kind of hard, because I think, at least don't lie. I don't know what that means. Either you tell the truth or you somehow divert the attention, maybe, or maybe there's, like, a lot of other possibilities other than just lying and telling the truth. But I think it's hard. A lot of us feel that. I mean, we have that. How do we be authentic in the world? How do we be truthful and still, there's a pressure to it. I mean, it's very silly that I brought up social media in the beginning, but there's a pressure, right? Like why can't we just be honest and truthful in our social media and our interactions in everything? There is this needful freedom of balance between your reality and my reality and all these nested realities of social interaction. So that gets complex too, right? Like, because when I speak something, it might be that I'm being truthful, but from your perspective or some other perspective, the interpretation of it might not be at all what I meant.
Yeah, so, that's another thing that comes in. Absolutely, yeah. So we're always, you know, I would like to not be this way, and I shouldn't say we or you. I'll talk about me. There's a part of me that's always calculating.
like what others will think or something?
I think I'm not calculating.
What do you mean calculating? Like how others are going to perceive what you're saying? Or
yeah, in when I start a sentence, as I'm speaking the sentence, I can feel myself midway through the sentence making some sort of a judgment of should I go this direction or that direction. And maybe part of that is coming from what I see on your face. If I see I kind of look come across your eyes like, yeah, I'm not sure where she's going with this, you know, or I don't know if I agree with that. I'll make tiny modifications and maybe say it in a slightly different way because I want it to land in a certain way. Well, that's a form of lying. That's a form of not being honest.
Really? I don't know. Isn't that more like aligning in the way we were talking about or calibrating?
Am I aligning to? Am I aligning to what's going to please you or what's going to meet the need at the moment? Or am I aligning to the truth?
I mean, that depends if you're changing your intention in that moment or if you're just changing the way in which you're articulating it, because those are very different things. Like if you're trying to express something to me and you're just gauging my bodily reaction and my what I say to you, I mean, that's what conversation is. We kind of dance with our different perspectives joining together until we can kind of open a path between them. That's what we are doing, right? Even now. So I wouldn't say that's lying. If anything, that's more like a dance of you've come from this way and I've come from this way. And now we have these different ways of being, but a lot of them overlap. So we're going to dance and figure out how to share the rhythm. And then we kind of are in the flow together, you know? That does not feel like a lie to me. However, if you were realizing that I thought the complete opposite of what you were saying, and so then you changed your language to agree with me, even though it's not what you want, like feel or think, then that's different, right? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think that's what you're doing. You're more dancing with everyone and finding a way.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that I find myself doing, if I really try to pay attention to what's happening when I'm talking, I find myself sometimes aligning to the conversation, which is a good thing. That's the dance. But maybe sometimes aligning to some body language of yours. And maybe it's not very obvious to me that that's happening until I go back and think about it. And I look back over the conversation. So there's this old Russian proverb. I think it's a Russian proverb. It was told to me by a woman who was a Russian. She said it was an old proverb she learned as a child. And that is that the truth once spoken becomes a lie. And what it means is this, at least I think what it means is this, because I thought about it for a long time. You can have an idea come up into your head whole, and it seems to you that it's so consonant with the truth that you have this idea. And then you start trying to express it. And once you start trying to verbalize it and put it into words, then words themselves are a little bit of a stumbling block because maybe I can't find quite the right word to express this idea that's in my head, or I can't put the words together in a way that's very articulate. And then maybe your body language or something goes across your eyes that maybe changes just one word of it a little bit. And by the time the idea is fully articulated, it's no longer as perfectly beautiful as it was when it was in my head. And so that's just the complications of trying to get, because I have my framework that's built up out of all the experiences I've ever had in life and all the songs I've heard and books I've read and all of that, right? That's my frame. It's coming through that lens or through that, let's say it's a filter. It's coming through that filter and then I'm speaking it and then you're hearing it and you're hearing it because you have a completely different filter. You're hearing it through your filter and then it gets into your brain and then you have to respond to it. And then it's coming out of your filter. And so we have this very imperfect attempt to come together and say something, you know, it's very complicated. I mean, communication is very complicated.
It's incredible. It's so complex and wonderful and seemingly impossible. Now I start to understand what you mean, because that's that needful freedom again too, and that's that, like, that we each have we are each in a different spatiotemporal position. And by spatiotemporal, I mean geographical, but also all those other, the social, the mental, the emotional, all of that. We have a very unique, dynamic sort of position, so to speak. Of course, it's more like a wave, but, and so we can never coincide perfectly, right? Like, as I was saying with the needful freedom, you never coincide with your own position, because a position is a measurement. We talked about that a bit last time. And so even when you're coming up with these ideas or thoughts, I mean, those are, you're kind of, you know, you're assessing them, but you're never coinciding 100% with those. And the same when you express them in language or when we try to communicate, nothing's ever going to fully coincide spatiotemporally with, like, I'm not going to coincide with your position in our bodies and also with what we're trying to express, because we're literally part of the same encounter. And you can't, we could even fold it over and we would be touching, but we can't become the same part of that ongoing encounter. So that's that thing where we can never like coincide with each other. At the same time, however, the patterns are very similar. And that's what happens when we express ourselves well, or we get into that state of where we're sharing the patterns, then something does happen and we almost become like one body, you know? I mean, you can see it in scientific studies too, where things do become such, they're not coinciding. They're not becoming the same thing. They're not taking each other's spatiotemporal place, but the patterns are so similar that you, it's not that I have a completely different pattern and you have a completely different pattern, but somehow we're resonating together. Or, I mean, there's all kind of language that you could use. But that's something that feels wonderful, right? And a lot of science comes out of that. Art comes out of that. It's that space where those things are shared, I guess. And all those failures and missteps and miscommunications are teaching us maybe how to open more to different patterns to one another. I don't know what you think about that. Maybe it, through art, maybe you have some way of seeing that. I don't know.
Well, when you were talking just now, I was thinking about like being in a band when you're playing with all the different instruments. And then there's this, maybe it's a little awkward when you first start working with this band, but then eventually you're all tuned up, you're all practiced up, and then you have a good conductor, and the conductor is conducting you in such a way that you can all come together and you're not taking the same space, but you're like interweaving with each other, right? And that interweaving, that moment when it all comes together, is such a feeling of glorious freedom, you know?
Isn't it?
Or isn't choir, it? Yeah. Choir is all, when your voices all get tuned up and and all the coloratura and all the vibrato and everything hits a moment when they just line up and they're intersecting with each other.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to express it. It makes me think of, you know, mind and life is music, this thing we've both talked to Watson about in a way, and a lot of different ways. But also it just makes me think of being at a, I was at a lot of good concerts in my life. And when you're, and when you have that, you know, there can be exactly that happens when you're in a space. It can happen with the audience and with the band members, like with the band members with each other and with the band members with the audience and with the audience with other members of the audience.
Yeah.
Somehow music makes it so visceral, right? Because that's really shared pattern in a way that we almost can, you can really understand that it's a shared pattern. And that happens, that space opens, and it everyone's a little bit like one. We are always connected, of course, but in those moments you don't need to feel judged, for example, and you don't need to feel lonely, and you just feel connected in a way that I think we all want. And it makes me, I mean, maybe it's one reason we try to do what we do and try to understand the world, because we want to open up more spaces like that. You know, someone who has, I was thinking as you were talking, of someone who has some mental problem or issue of that being, you're kind of hearing a different music when you're in that space, you know, and no other people aren't hearing that music, or you can't hear the music they hear. There's a misalignment that is happening, or you can't share patterns very easily. And instead you just end up turning into your own patterns, which makes it worse. So yeah, I want to open that up. As you were talking, I was thinking, gosh, I want to like somehow apply that music idea to the things that hurt us, or to, even just to feeling anxious or feeling judged, but also to other bigger issues that affect our lives. Like, yeah, how do we do that? I don't know.
Well,
How?
you just mentioned that you had a talk with Richard Watson on your channel. And
Yeah, a couple
he's
of
the
them.
one who talks about song as life and mind.
That's how we met, and we think we said it last time, but we were both talking to him about his theory of music of mind and life, and somehow we got on the same email thread.
Yeah.
But
So
yeah.
what did you think about his whole theory? Did you watch all the episodes where the 5 episodes where he did like 7.5 hours of laying out the theory?
I think I watched it when he sent it before he'd made it public, like last year, you or something, and I find a lot of overlap with Richard's work, with his way of coming at things, with the fact that he brings love into it and really talks about it, and the scientific approach, the different way of thinking about evolution. I think we both have talked to him, so I won't. I think probably have 5 hours of talking about this stuff with him, so I couldn't go back over it. But I love thinking about mind and life as music. I think it's very helpful as a metaphor, and as Richard talks about often, metaphors mean a lot more than we think, and they're. But I also think it's even deeper than that. I do think, as I was maybe just kind of describing, and you brought up music too, it's. That's not disconnected from what he's trying to say. There is a kind of vibration that's happening. The body is a vibration. I mean, you can. The trick is, how do you think about this literally and scientifically without it getting too metaphorical or too mystical? Not that those are bad things, but in science, you're having a different language. And he's doing that, right? That's what he's trying to do. So, I mean, I think it's wonderful. I talked to him a little bit about von Uxkull and this musical idea. There's a few things in the philosophy that I've studied that resonate a lot with that notion of thinking of mind and life as, first of all, one thing, you know, in this cognition of scaling that we both like so much. And also of that as being maybe understood in a way if you understand the patterns of change, the way you might understand patterns of change in music. I think that's oversimplifying what he's saying, but I find it very helpful. What about you? Did you?
Well, just this morning I was listening to I think I was listening to Christian Baxter and Drew's Ecology is his handle on Twitter. I can't think of his last name, but Drew is very connected to ethnomusicology. So looking at music throughout different ethnic groups and throughout the time of history and all of that. And I think they were talking about Boethius and his Consolation of Philosophy, or maybe it was something that he had actually written on music. But the idea that he came up with, and this is like 1500 years ago, is that music is actually the condensation or the entirety of reality kind of compressed into music. So when you look at music, you're looking at the fractal of all of life. And so pretty interesting that 1500 years ago Boethius came up with that, and that's more or less what Richard is talking about. That if you look at the fractal of music, you're going to see the fractal of how all of life actually works. Because everything is a rhythm, even a musical tone has a frequency. And it's not only its own frequency, but it's all of the harmonics, the frequency of all the harmonics that are above that tone. And a tone is only a tone if it's moving through time, because otherwise it's just a beep. Even that takes time, so you can't hear anything without time. And of course, the melody is time. And there's so many things that work out through music that make it, plus the idea, a symphony is. My physicist friend is always saying that computation is just a symphony of choices over time. And so all of the computations that we make are a choice between this or that. Every single choice that we make is this or that all the way through time. And music is that. So you condense all of that into music, then you have a fractal of the universe. And I thought that was a pretty interesting thought. And I didn't realize that Boethius had already said that 1500 years ago.
Yeah, it's very strange, but once you start to see things through patterns and start to try to look at the world, which is very difficult, we're all trying to do it and it's hard to do and it's hard to communicate. Yeah. When you start to look at it through complexity, through scaling, through nestedness, through fractals, however we want to say it, when you start to notice that that's the way the world is, and it's so different than the way we, our language and our, all of our alignment right now is towards a linearity and a dualistic, not that those are bad, but this either or linear stuff, but you start to get a taste of, oh, it's actually really different. And it's, there's not a beginning and end, and depending where you're going to measure from, everything is going to scale and nest, you know, in lots of different ways. And the fracticality is basically what I mean. When you start to notice that, I think so many people have throughout time, then you have to find some way to communicate that and to give a way to structure it that people can understand and that can help them, you know? In a way, maybe that's what music is. I mean, so we've talked about it before, I think. I don't know if it was on screen or off screen, but about art and music, art in all forms, like writing, music, mm-hmm. painting, as being a space where we share patterns, in a sense, where we do open one another to our different paths of fracticality, so mm-hmm. to speak. And music does it so immediately. It does it as it, you know? Yeah. I don't think it's, I'm not saying it's better than art, painting, and writing, but with painting and art and writing, you do kind of need some sort of symbolic language or something. With the music, you need the instrument, but the instrument is so, the instrument and the body and the effect are so much spatio-temporally, as you were saying, so much more closer, I guess, like they're happening more at once mm-hmm. than when you paint something and someone sees it or you write it, that I think that fracticality gets expressed, you know? So I guess what it makes sense to do what Richard is trying to do, which is like turn that the other way and start to look at it as building, as telling us something about how we can structure our science, in a sense. I don't know if, yeah, I don't know, but yeah. But what are you thinking of as I ramble on here?
Well, I guess one of the reasons I asked about Richard is he's so out, you know, you talk about edge work. He is out there mm-hmm. on the edge.
Absolutely.
And he's so courageous in being willing to talk about this kind of edge that he's on, mm-hmm. As is Michael Levin. The other day I was listening to Kurt Jaimungal with Alfonso Arias talk about biology, and he had asked Alfonso Arias what he thought of Michael Levin, and Alfonso Arias said, well, you know, I really like a lot of what he's doing, but he's so far out there on the edge that he's out beyond the science already. He's saying things that can't be proven yet. So he's not trying to prove it and then say it. He's saying it, and then he's going to go out there and try to prove it, which I guess is kind of verboten in science.
Yeah, but he really tries to do the opposite of that. He tries to always preface it with, this is just speculation, I'm just talking,
yes.
you know, but those things get lost. And I mean, he's also doing real science and experiments and so on.
Absolutely.
But you're right. I mean, he's opening to the sci-fi too.
He's willing to go outside and then come up with an idea and then try it, which is what Einstein did. I mean, right? I mean, Einstein had these ideas way before they could even be tested. And if you don't have some people who are willing to do that and get out there on the edge, then how are we ever going to move forward, you know?
No, it's back to that, exactly where we started with the risk of failure and the risk of error and the way that evolution actually works through mutation and through mistake, through error of the DNA or whatever, and with the needful freedom of never being able to fully align and within that space of misalignment is the freedom. And I think taking that on as an individual, where you're doing that in a sense, where you have to kind of do it within a structure, and you're always at the edge of that structure, such as in academia, is a really fine balance, right? And a lot of those people that we've talked to or are doing that, but hopefully doing it, I think doing it responsibly. And at least that's what I hope. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. I
think they're all wanting, they're doing it from the right place, you know? I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but it's important. That goes back to what I was saying about finding the balance. You don't want to push too far, because we're all at risk of that, you know, of pushing into some place where we've kind of gone past the Markov blanket of sanity.
Yeah. Well, to just bring it back to this whole thing about the, you know, you're talking about pushing into the unknown and the edge work and all that kind of thing. One of the things that at the beginning, I said that rejection of the unknown is tantamount to identification with the devil, because it's a consequence of Luciferian pride, which states all that I know is all that is necessary to know. Peterson goes on to say that if people make this totalitarian assumption of omniscience, that they know everything they need to know, it inevitably develops into hell. And then he says this hell develops because creative exploration, which is impossible without humble acknowledgement of the unknown. So when you recognize that this thing is unknown, that's a sign of humility, really. And creative exploration is a willingness to go out into the unknown and explore.
Mm-hmm.
So this constitutes the process that constructs and maintains the protective, adaptive structure that gives life much of its acceptable meaning. So the whole thing of moving out into the unknown all the time and being willing to risk that is what is actually building the world. Without it, we don't have a world. We're building the world all the time because we're pushing up against the unknown, finding what we can there, bringing it back and adding it to what we have so far. And I mean, you know, we have all these cliches, we are standing on the shoulders of giants. Yes, because they went before us and they mm-hmm. pushed against the unknown. They went out there on the edge. They were doing the way making, right?
Yeah, they made the ways that we now use to make our ways. They're sort of parameterizing them, but we still have to make our own way. We find ways, but we're also making our way, because there's never, in the same way our bodies aren't ever able to coincide, we can't fully ever coincide with another way, another path. So even though we have all these ones open to us, we're always kind of creating a new one in the ones that we take, right? Which ones I take, which ones you take. And what I heard you saying there, in a way, is what Socrates was saying too, or like, I know, all I know is that I don't know. As long as you're in that space, you're aware of the unknown, and that you're constantly, everything is changing, and there's no way to know everything, right? So when I hear someone, if some of the people we were just talking about started to say, hey, I got the right answer, this is the way it is, I know it's correct, I would be worried. Yeah. As long as they're in the space of, I don't know if this is right, I'm just thinking, I've done all this research, here are the patterns I've seen, I just want to put it out there. That's a hard space to stay in, because people want you to have the answer. They want you to be the guru. They want you to tell them, this is the way it is. And they might even say that you said that if you didn't. But if the person themselves, whether it's Mike Levin or Jordan Peterson or whoever, or me or you, I mean, all of us in our life, if we're in that space of curiosity, learning, doing the research, taking it very seriously, but also knowing we're always in the moving into the unknown. We're always creating the way. We never can fully have the answer. I trust that space, you know, and I trust people who do their best to tread that and ride that wave, you know. And I do think those are the people who change the world for the better and open up new ways in the way that you just, and as you just said, it does take a lot of energy and poise, you know, to be able to do it.
Well, and what we were talking about earlier on is this idea of the interest that's drawing you forward. Each person's interest is unique and different. And that's why each of us is in a different space. And it has to be that way. Because if we were all coalescing around one interest, then the world would just become static, like a crystal, you know. But
they would have, that would be the need, but not the freedom. So you would just be stuck. You would be coinciding perfectly and nothing moves.
So then he goes on to say loyalty to that personal interest is equivalent to an identification with the archetypal hero. And that's his
Joseph Campbell kind of thing, right? Yeah.
Well, but even more than that,
follow your bliss.
Yeah, not so I'm glad you brought that up, because it's not, I don't think it's the same thing as follow your bliss, but because the archetypal hero actually has to do battle, has to go over into the chaos and do battle with the dragons there, because there
But I think that's part of the whole archetype of the Joseph Campbell thing too, that you're basically going to the edge of death or whatever, and you're meeting the dragons and all that.
But I guess maybe what I'm objecting to is the way that pop culture has.
Absolutely. You don't feel the bliss all the time. You're not living in bliss all the time. Yeah, that's true. It's a lot of discomfort and failure to follow your bliss.
Right? It's a lot of discomfort and
failure. Yeah, I see your point.
We're right back to failure and risk taking.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the path forward. It has to always be the path forward.
That's true. Yeah.
Which brings us full circle. Here we are.
I think so. I think that's a good place to kind of take a breath. Don't know if I told you my dog's kept me up all night. She wasn't doing too good. So I'm sorry if my eyes are a little tired. It's just from not sleeping much, but it's been wonderful talking to you. And I think we got into some of the scales. I don't know if it relates much to what you're going to talk about in the conference, but that was a very nested scaling
I don't want to
conversation.
Talk about what's in the conference yet, or nobody will come to the conference.
Okay. So we keep that quiet.
So this was really good, Andrea. Thank you so much for joining me. And
It's been wonderful, Karen. I'm so happy to see you again.
I know a tiny bit about a lot of different things, and what I do know, I know very imperfectly. And I know that you have a very deep, deep structure in these areas of philosophy and neuroscience. So I apologize if the things that I say sound a little bit imprecise, like the whole thing about the brainstem. I'm trying to think as I go, trying to remember Soames's book about how consciousness arises and all that. So I know I got a lot of things wrong, but thank you for your patience.
I was not having that feeling. We were talking in a general way, and that's, you don't need to be specific about all of these things. It's more, I'm just used to other neuroscientists. If they hear it, then they'll catch on something and stop listening. So that's why I just sometimes qualify things, because first of all, there's no one has one theory about the brainstem. So, you know, don't worry.
Okay. Well, you have a great day. And what's your dog?
You too.
What's your doggie's name?
Her name is Hollywood. She was named by the Mongolian person who gave her to me in Mongolia.
Oh, wow.
Hollywood. Yeah.
And I'm going to put your
Holly.
Channel in the description section for people who want to go over and check out what you're doing, because you're doing a lot of cool things.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. Yeah. I would love people's input about the waymaking and helping me with the sort of community philosophy, help me build it in a way that helps people.
Sounds great. Thank you, Andrea.
Thanks, Karen, for all you're doing.